Track This Thread, Chapter 2. Pepper finds him 6 hours later in the postmodern dungeon, curled up like a centipede around an iPad on either a terribly designed chair or an abominably designed bed. Clint doesn't understand why, if Stark has money forever, everything he owns is so fucking clinical and awful to sit on or look at. "Sorry to come unannounced," she tells him, and holds up a Stark tab. There is a giant purple bow on it, and a tag that Clint can spy with his assassin's eye. Says, "Girl on fire, try this out for size." "I was informed if I didn't bring you one of these to replace your iPad, my head of R&D was going to fling himself off of a building." Clint stares. "Aren't you the CEO?" he asks, because his memories of Natasha's colorful, effusive complaints during her stint as Pepper's PA inform a vision of Pepper's schedule which barely leaves sufficient time for bathroom breaks, much less putting up with Tony's bullshit. Maybe Pepper has a time turner. "I'm also, stupidly, dating Tony," she laughs, and motions at one of the leather things. "Sorry I barged in. May I?" Clint waves a hand. "Go on. It's your apartment." Pepper frowns at him. "Clint, it's your apartment. This building literally has Stark's name on it," he reminds her, "because he likes Pepper. Ish. But a lot of times conversations with her give him flashbacks to his early run-ins with social workers. Well-intentioned rich ladies telling him they can fix his life have never actually managed to fix his life. And Clint's not really optimistic that having failed to address the more simplistic issues of his youth, needing to get a GED, stop getting arrested for petty theft, no more trick-rolling truckers, this method will work on his grown-up problems. Getting mind-fucked by a demigod, killing a bunch of his co-workers, being in love with a dead guy. Thank God, Pepper doesn't press her hand to Clint's hand or try and pep-talk him or anything awful. She just rolls her eyes. You each have individual leases to your floors, and you would not believe the things Tony writes his name on that don't technically belong to him, she says, like this is normal for her now. Clint raises his eyebrows. Stark doesn't own the building with Stark written on it? For a number of tax reasons, a REIT spun off of Stark Industries owns the building. We're technically tenants, Pepper replies, and Clint's expression must be sufficiently horrified to stop her explanation dead in its tracks. But that's not what I came here to talk to you about. Clint glances at the Stark tab. I brought you this because Tony would have whined all afternoon otherwise, she clarifies, tracking his gaze, before tossing it onto a nearby furniture-like object and turning her attention back to Clint, uncomfortably focused. Jarvis says you're not sleeping. Clint glares at the ceiling, which stays silent, presumably out of artificial guilt. I know it's not my place to ask, really, Pepper goes on, twisting her hands together in her lap. She's wearing one of those suits that matches Coulson's closet. So gorgeously simple, it can't possibly have cost as much as it did. But I at least see Bruce and Steve and Natalie, well, I guess it's Natasha, around the common areas. This is the second time I've seen you since you've moved into the building. Clint says, I'm fine. Which sounds unconvincing coming from normal people, and sounds just fucking embarrassing coming out of his mouth. Pepper stares at him some more before she says, Okay, I can accept that. Coulson had drawn up an exhaustive 56-page briefing on Virginia Potts, chief of staff of Stark Industries, Inc., SI on the Dow, responsible single-handedly for the 6% drop in the DJIA the day Tony had gone on TV and said he was shutting down their weapons manufacturing business. He'd also put together a single-page summary for everybody unlikely to possess the professional discipline to read the entire summary. And he'd said it while sliding the printer page directly across a conference room table at Clint. So Clint knows this. Virginia Potts graduated in the top 70th percentile of her high school class and went on to Agnes Scott, where she majored in economics with a minor in business management. She'd spent the 2 years after that at a fixed income desk at Lehman Brothers before she moved for a 3-year stint to Hong Kong to become one of just a handful of women working on the prop desk at Standard Chartered. That lasted until Santander came sniffing after her, and she lasted in their head office less than 4 months. Gross sexual harassment, Coulson had summarized, before she packed it in for Goldman Sachs, where she spent a short lifetime until she had the misfortune of working a number of short-term issuances with Stark Industries, then treasurer. Over the course of 3 years, she left the MD track on Water Street and went to Stark, where she toiled in quiet obscurity for another 5 years before Tony managed to trap her in an elevator with him during a period where he was using Stark Industries' Midtown headquarters for experimental infrastructure engineering. 6 hours and a number of screaming matches audible through the steel doors of the elevator later, Tony had crawled out looking bamboozled, verklempt, and a little slapped, and promptly stole Pepper for himself. He tried to get her named his personal assistant. The board had wisely ignored this, in favor of creating a chief of staff position and letting Tony be someone else's problem. "And I will continue to accept that for another 2 months," Pepper goes on, "because this is a woman who has grit her teeth through 4 investment banks and years trailing Tony Stark in 3-inch heels. After which point, I will stop goaltending and let Tony come after you. Understood?" "You are exactly as mean as I figured you'd have to be to keep Stark under control," Clint marvels at her. "A little bit in love right now, because his apparent weakness for assholes is gender indiscriminate." Pepper smiles. "Thank you," she tells him, and raises to her feet, towering in a pair of strappy gray shoes that could double as torture devices. She nods at the Stark tab. "And you should try it. I'm gathering feedback on how non-intuitive it is, so I can crush the operating system before Tony tries to push it into production." Clint laughs, surprising himself, and Pepper grins back. "Seriously, be vicious," she invites. "I can already imagine the Gizmodo takedown otherwise." Being vicious about the StarkTab operating system is pretty easy, because while it doesn't require a command line prompt, it's wildly overcomplicated for anybody whose brain doesn't operate like Tony's. Most of the menus are transparent and poorly labeled, and while the whole thing is pretty zippy, it takes Clint almost an hour to figure out how to get his email imported onto the thing. A thankless exercise, in the end, since the top of his fucking inbox is an email from Fury. There's no body to the note, just 0600, written in the subject line. Because Fury's a dick who doesn't get a lot of sleep and likes to punish everybody else around him for his shitty life choices. Pepper said 2 more months, so Clint figures he'll socialize maybe in 1 month and 29 days. For now, he unearths one of his stash of sweet and sour chicken MREs, flagrantly stolen out of a SHIELD supply warehouse, and settles in. The future is fucking awful, and no matter what Pepper says, if she can get through the front door without having to pick a lock or get Clint's attention first, it's not his apartment. But if his options are a windowless room at headquarters, or a holding cell in the helicarrier, or here, Clint chooses here. And right now, he closes his eyes and presses the heels of his hand into the sockets, sinking into the pressure and weight, seeing and not seeing the borealis of non-colors underneath his eyelids. He writes Stark 22 single-side pages in dull and duller and unreadably smeared pencil across yellow legal paper. It's more or less all one incredibly long run-on sentence, and there's a 5-page section where Clint starts every sentence with the phrase, "so like," followed by feeling words about the user design, Because the mandatory workplace sessions about open communication have to come in useful somewhere. He leaves his commentary folded into a monstrous paper airplane with zero aerodynamic qualities, beaching it on the common area breakfast counter with, "For Stark, re your iPad knockoff," written in a clear space on one of the wings. By the time he finishes all of this, Clint looks up at the clock and finds it's almost 2 a.m. It leaves him trying not to feel too grateful that he only has 2 more hours to kill before he can justify heading out for his meeting. On some level, he knows this is sad. This is the person S.H.I.E.L.D. found in a ditch in Seoul before they built him up to be Clint Barton instead of just Hawkeye. But he's tired. He can feel pieces of himself breaking off. He managed to contain himself underneath his fraying skin. And for the moment, this is the very best he's going to be able to do. Fury has a rotating cast of 6 assistants, all of whom have security clearances high enough they have nullify clauses in their employment contracts. Most field agents beyond L5, and all administrative agents, have the rider attached to their shitty photocopies with information about S.H.I.E.L.D.'s loose interpretation of the Family Medical Leave Act. Dollar for dollar, up to 5%, 401k matching contributions, and standard verbiage about non-discrimination in hiring or promotion based on gender, age, race, or sexual orientation. Oh, by the way, if you ever fall into enemy hands and your successful retrieval is deemed impossible, you'll be assassinated by one of our own to prevent what you know from getting into the intelligence community. Also, see Suha Chatterjee in HR to sign up for a seminar on how to quit smoking and lower your monthly insurance premium. Assistant number 2, male, Nigerian, hopeless crush on Sitwell, is parked in front of Fury's absurd office with an industrial-sized Sharpie redacting something. "Hey, you," Clint says feebly. Clint thinks he sounds normal. He's wearing jeans and a woman's gray hoodie because his life is embarrassing and he's been reduced to stealing Natasha's clothes. He can tell from Assistant Number 2's unimpressed expression it doesn't fit right, which means he's going to get his ass beat for stretching it out of shape later, too. "You still can't pronounce my name, can you?" Assistant Number 2 asks, after a long beat. "You have like 5 names," Clint pleads, because Assistant Number 2 knows full fucking well that Clint's so bad at sounding out names that it goes straight from pathetic into offensive. The first week Fury stole Assistant Number 2 from the DOD's analyst program for S.H.I.E.L.D., Perry from HR was in near literal tears trying to get the kid's details into the internal system so he could get paid and get enrolled for dental. "Barton, stop letting my fucking assistant troll you and get your stupid ass in here," Fury roars from inside his office. And Assistant Number 2 smirks and goes back to redacting who the hell knows what as Clint slinks inside, hands stuffed into his pockets. He's barely finished saying, "Sir," when Fury cuts in with, "What the actual fuck are you wearing, Barton?" Clint says, clothes? Fury looks briefly like he wishes he could stab out his other eye. "Barton, are we not paying you enough?" "Actually, since I'm on suspension, I think you're not paying me at all right now," Clint says helpfully, because Suha had bullied him into taking a bunch of long overdue financial literacy classes during lunch breaks at S.H.I.E.L.D., and he has a budget and everything now. Admittedly, she'd done it because Coulson was a fucking narc to the bones and emailed her to say Clint had bought a semi-condemned building in Bed-Stuy. "So you've resorted to hustling in the interim?" Fury guesses. Clint flings himself down into one of the leather guest chairs. There's no thrill to Fury accusing him of looking like a prostitute, he thinks. "What did you want to see me about, sir?" he asks, instead of asking if he wants the price list, which had been great, so great, because it made Coulson grin that one time. Fury moves like he's arming a weapon, his arms levering him out of his desk chair, like he's taking the safety off a gun. The leather duster is tossed over a low bookshelf, but the effect's still there as Fury stalks around his desk so he can get in Clint's face in a more literal, aggressive sense of the phrase. Xavier says you're clear. Are you clear, Barton? He asks. Clint's mouth goes dry, and he defaults to autopilot. That's not up to me, sir. Bullshit, Fury spits. All of this, he waves at the pile of papers on his desk. All the reviews and Xavier and everything is just a dog and fucking pony show. The only person who's going to really know is you. He stares at Clint, hard, scowling. So I am asking you, Agent Clinton Francis Barton, are you clear? A couple of years back, on an op that had gone whiskey tango about 2 months in, Clint had gotten dosed with some fucked up truth serum, and Coulson had been pulled off general field operation to come pluck his ass out of Dodge. The extraction had gone okay for the most part, but the military transpo back to a U.S. base in Germany had been excruciating. All the comforts of running the gauntlet at the New Orleans Saints rookie camp, and the object of at least half of Clint's most mortifying secrets hovering over him like a nanny goat in a Brioni suit. Fury has the same effect. That drugging undertow that makes it next to impossible to lie to him. And Clint just stares into Fury's good eye like he's being hypnotized by a python and mumbles, I'm all alone in here. But Fury's not Coulson, so he doesn't dole out a steady supply of Trident to keep Clint's mouth occupied and not talking. He doesn't put in earplugs with exonerating certainty and go back to a stack of reports in his lap. Fury keeps his gaze fixed on Clint's face, in the near-middle distance, until the silence has welled up into something muffling and uncomfortable. And then he waits another half minute before saying, Good. Report to medical. Let's get that fucking chip out of you. It's a goddamn field liability. Clint feels bruised and fragile by the time medical is done with him. He steals a fleece jacket from op supplies for someone about Thor-sized and huddles in it. The tracking bracelet had been removed by one nondescript security officer or another. There had been a recent influx of West Coast transfers and new hires. Clint tries not to think about why, but the chip had been a literal pain. The whole process had involved local anesthesia, two nurses, and a neurosurgeon. Because SHIELD likes to put chips in places where self-administered extraction is likely to result in paralysis. By the time the medical glue had dried and everything had been patched up, a probie agent had dropped by with Clint's SHIELD-issued phone, hideous, Clint's personal mobile, worse, and everything he'd been carrying when they'd taken him in for debriefing and evaluation. $3.67, two sticks of gum, his house keys, a Captain America key ring he'd seen in a random shit store and bought because he's fucking pathetic, and a 6-year-old condom. The probie agent's expression had been telling. Fucking what, agent? Clint snaps. Because fuck it. He's old and senior enough. The kid looks meaningfully at the condom. Nothing. Long pause. Sir. Clint mutters, You have got to be shitting me, under his breath, because he doesn't have to put up with getting sassed by fucking probies. He hangs around HQ long enough to stop by his locker and collect a few things. Watch, wallet, Swiss Army knife. He stuffs a few shirts and jeans into the crumpled up duffel bag at the bottom of the unit and swaps the purple chucks crammed into the corner of the locker for his combat boots. There's other stuff in here too. Little pieces left over from Clint getting too comfortable. And the locker looks lived in a way that sometimes his apartment doesn't. There's a crinkling old A section of the Financial Times lining the top shelf that has an inadvertent picture of Natasha in the background of a G8 conference, pulling her hair into a bun while Clint holds her purse like a henpecked husband. There's a bunch of fading Clutch and Grin Polaroids of random strangers from a brief undercover gig as a wedding photographer. And there's a classic one of Sitwell in a bad suit trying to get Melinda May to do the electric slide with him. He's got ratty books, including, fuck, something literally a year overdue from the Brooklyn Public Library. And for reasons currently inexplicable, a half dozen rolled up copies of People magazine, curled together in the back behind a bunch of wrist guards and tape. This has been his locker at S.H.I.E.L.D. for the entire time Clint's worked for them. It was the third thing they'd ever given him, after an ID code and a standard recovery chip under his right collarbone. Clint doesn't remember who it was that showed him the locker, but he remembers the way he'd searched every Duane Reade and bodega in the city for just the right lock, torn between the purple combo or the more classic side coat gold. Much younger and a little bit dumber, this locker had been the first sign of something more permanent. Clint had loved it in a way that bordered on obsession. He doesn't know when he lost the reverence, or maybe he just chilled the fuck out. When he chilled the fuck out, but it's strange now to be standing in front of years of accrued, overlooked certainty in the wake of fucking everything up, and missing the person he was when he threw that fucking book in here and forgot about it for months. Fuck, Clint says to nobody, and shuts the locker door too hard. Outside of the carefully curated radius around S.H.I.E.L.D., Manhattan looks like Shanghai in 1998. Cranes and construction dust pluming everywhere, floodlights overhead long into the night. He walks because the 456 has been shittier than ever since the Battle of New York, and between Natasha's hoodie and the S.H.I.E.L.D. fleece, he's good in the October air. But even catastrophic alien attack and the slow cleanup hasn't kept fall out of the city, and every sidewalk is slicked with rain, blackened from it, with orange and yellow leaves decoupaged onto the cement and cluttered in the gutter pools. Clint's walking towards Lower Manhattan, and the streets are as empty as they ever get at 8 p.m. Moderately, without the usual influx of tourists who are wandering around the fucking island trying to find bouquets of freshly sharpened pencils. He stays on Lexington, which is opened up for traffic and people, unlike Park, which is still a hot goddamn mess of construction and road crews. The worst of the debris has all been moved to a barge parked off of the harbor, with architects picking through the rubble to see what can be repaired and repurposed. The large-scale version of gluing a mug back together. Only the mug is Grand Central. This far east, he misses the worst of Times Square, and huffs his duffel a bit higher when he hits Murray Hill. On 28th, he ducks into Celestian's to buy their biggest tub of baba ganoush and some pita, and doesn't think about how the first time he'd been here, he'd been stalking Coulson through the city, curious about his new handler. He closes the 14 blocks between him and Union Square, and gives as wide a berth as you ever can to the streams of people flowing into and out of Forever 21, the Strawberry, the DSW, the Square, flanked by their drum circles. He looks at the doomsday clock, holding steady at its May 3rd number, and Clint thinks how fucking weird it is to be living in a city filled with real and pseudo-intellectuals and not have anybody see to realize the strangeness of that. It's October. Thousands are dead. Earth is not alone. The L into Brooklyn is a fucking nightmare, because it's always a fucking nightmare. And the occupants in the last car split themselves into three primary groups. Yuppies, who aren't looking at Clint. Hipsters, who aren't looking at Clint. And people who are staring at Clint's arms. The only people who ever try to cruise him on the train are looking for something a lot more fucked up than Clint wants to offer, though. So he just zones out, reading his year-overdue copy of... What the hell is this? Clint flips around for the title card, because of course he's lost the plasticky cover. and finds out he's reading something called To Hate Like This Is to Be Happy Forever, about basketball and the South, which are two things he has less than zero interest in. There's a steady drizzle by the time Clint's tripping up the front steps to his building, and he sees a dumb leak and that the painting's a little fucked. Screw Katie Kate. Clint's great at landlords, and he makes a note to write that shit down on his hand when he finds a pen, and after he gets his dog. He has to swear for a little while before his house keys work, and then he has to swear some more when he swings the door to get his apartment open, and the first thing he gets is a fucking skillet to the face. Motherfuck, Clint says, and goes down like a sack of potatoes, in a way that is fucking embarrassing, because all things even, he's supposed to be a fucking super spy. Kate says, oh shit, and Lucky fucking helpfully steps all over Clint's crotch so he can lick effusively, tenderly, at Clint's throbbing face. 2 hours later, the neighbors have brought him, in order, some tuna noodle casserole, a bunch of newspaper cutouts of him making stupid goddamn faces in the middle of the Battle of New York, whatever leftover bodega dog stuff they've been buying Lucky, and some aspirin, because Clint doesn't have any aspirin, okay? Shut up, Kate. You didn't buy any aspirin either, Clint mutters, in between spoonfuls of room-temperature tuna casserole. It's really not as bad as Kate's expression is telegraphing. Lucky, head more or less glued to Clint's knee, fat ass happily parked on Clint's chuck, makes a woofing noise and drools some. Clint guesses this means the fat bastard is glad Clint's back. Although, as soon as Kate clears out, and he runs out of this fucking terrible-looking, high-end brown rice and soy protein diet, Lucky's going right back on normal dog food. 9 years old, spoiled rotten, and trying to make Clint's dog uppity. I did not need aspirin, Kate retorts, holding a sock full of ice cubes from 2D's freezer, because Clint's freezer has two plastic Bennett's bottles of vodka in it, to his cheek and punching him in the arm at the same time. Unlike some people who live in unmedicated squalor, blind to the wonders of modern science and pharmacology. I wouldn't need aspirin if you didn't hit me in the face with a pan, Clint complains and asks, why the hell are you squatting here anyway? Kate's face smooths out into expressionless serenity, which is how Clint always knows she's really upset about something, but that he's not going to get it out of her. Clint used to think the way Natasha could shut down the emotional discourse was a spy thing. And now that he's got an upstart baby Archer in his life, he thinks it's a lady thing. Maybe it's a terrible learned skill, like Clint knows how not to get eaten by lions and stuff. Something ingrained for survival. But it still pisses him off that Kate scams him into talking about all sorts of stuff by confusing him with alternate yelling and touching his face with her hands, worried. You're stupid aliens. They were Loki's aliens, Clint interrupts. Destroyed my entire block, Kate goes on, blithe. And when I came over to yell at you about it, you weren't here, and your neighbor said you hadn't called about Lucky. So obviously I decided to wait here until you got back, so I could kick your ass. There's a lot she's not saying about her destroyed block and why she came. But all of the questions Clint wants to ask about if she's okay, if she was scared, why did she stay here and wait for him, sound dumb inside the echo chamber of his own head. Clint's used to being dumb in the echo chamber of his own head, but he hates hearing it fill up the air around him. He just swallows back the question with a mouthful of tuna and says, that wasn't my ass you kicked when I came in the door. Kate cocks an eyebrow. Oh, really? I could never tell the difference. He'd get mad at her, but it's not even the worst thing she said to him since she hit him on the head with his own skillet. So Clint says, whatever, and starts searching around for his remote, because he remembers there being like 7 episodes of Dog Cops on his DVR he'd been saving. Clint's finishing up the casserole while Mr. Whiskers makes his grand re-entry into the scene, like the drama queen he is, when out of the blue, Kate starts crying. "Oh, God, why? What are you doing?" Clint begs, already begging, knee-jerk. She seizes him by the collar of his shirt and drags him over to cry on, shoulders shaking, hands still fisted in the fabric. And Clint arches his back so they're not touching too much and tries to pat her head, only he's holding the casserole dish with one hand and a fork in the other. This is pretty much as successful as any other time a girl's cried on him, which even Clint knows is sad. "I thought you were dead," she says, after forever, after like 6 years of crying. Clint stares at the top of her head, at her greasy hair, and thinks that he's never seen her hair greasy before, and that right now she must be a mess. "I was on TV? But you didn't come back, you piece of shit!" Kate yells into his chest, because her forehead is now glued to his shoulder. "I thought you were dead, and I was going to have to take Lucky back to my house because you were dead and nobody would even tell me." There's not a good answer to this, because Kate's right. Clint's been almost dead a ton, and they don't call Kate. They usually don't even call Natasha, because 9 out of 10 times, it was her who carried him like a fainting heroine out of a war zone and into SHIELD Medical, swearing the entire time. And maybe SHIELD called Coulson, the times when Coulson hadn't listened to whatever happened to Clint over the two-way. And Clint couldn't even tell Kate that, don't worry, someone from SHIELD would have let her know, because with Coulson dead, no one would. All Clint can say is, "I'm sorry, Katie Kate. I'm sorry." And rests the side of his hand, still carrying the casserole, on top of her greasy head. Lucky whining and worried on the floor. In the background, Dog Cops keeps playing through the first act into the commercial. And Clint sits there holding a fork and a crying Hawkeye with a sock full of ice on his face. And feels underwater, overwhelmed, completely at loose ends. At 3 a.m., Clint finds himself in bed with a puffy-faced teenage girl, but hunched over a tablet and perving over someone else completely. He'd managed to get Kate to let go of him after another 2 episodes of Dog Cops had played through. The season is terrible so far. And she'd taken a shower and stolen a bunch of clothes from him. Right now, she's curled up on the left side of his bed with a pair of sweatpants that has Riot Girls written across the ass. Clint has no idea. And an Army Rangers t-shirt Clint absolutely cannot look at. And not because it's stretched weirdly across her tiny boobs. He doesn't know why he has it, how he got it, and really doesn't want to remember if he's ever jerked off in it. She'd only been convinced to sleep if Clint stayed close enough for random punching. Man, what is his life? So he sat on the other side of the bed and felt like a creep. An hour into it, once her breathing had deepened and evened out and included, at random intervals, a hilariously piggy little snore, he'd gone and gotten his iPad and opened up that file Jarvis had been compiling. He was skimming mostly at this point. Coulson had never said anything about his job, although he mentions coworkers. Clint figures out that Coulson calls Maria Hill the other sad bastard, because there's a story in here from a couple of years back that's totally innocuous but completely memorable about the weekend she and Coulson got locked into a conference room together thanks to some tech update glitches. Sitwell's just nicknamed, affectionately, the Patsy guy. Fury's boss. There's some other passing mentions. And Clint had read and read and read to try and find himself. But Coulson doesn't talk about Arrow Guy, or Hawk Guy, or Fuck Up Guy, or ex-circus guy at all. Nothing Clint can figure might be him. He tries not to be pissed about this, but he doesn't try too hard. You shoot people in the face for a guy and bring him popsicles for years, and this is the bullshit you get? There's this continuing thread of a guy named Bucky and another troll called Dum Dum giving Coulson crap about an apparent stillborn office crush on someone named Pam. Aside from the mind-blowing impossibility of Coulson having a crush, it makes Clint even angrier in a way he doesn't have a right to be. But fuck Coulson anyway, for the way nothing ever touched him, nothing got to him, nobody made a mark on him. He might have been a Captain America nerd and a person under his suits, but that was always under the suits. And it didn't matter how many times Strike Team Delta had bled on each other. Coulson's ties and neatly buttoned cuffs had been the Rubicon, the uncrossable divide. Nothing in or out. In the Congo once, Coulson had given a live field transfusion to Clint with a semi-dirty catheter and some needles he'd stolen out of a first aid kit belonging to child traffickers. And how fucking messed up is that? That Clint has Coulson's blood running through his veins and he can't figure out who fucking Pam is. Clint remembers, just a little bit, the way Coulson had said, "Sit down, Barton," and shoved him into a chair, stripped off his jacket and rolled up his sleeves, and ignored all of Clint's barely audible protests. He remembers their backup yelling at Coulson on the radio, and he remembers Coulson pulling out his comm, folding it into Clint's lax hand, and saying, "Here, Barton, hold this for me." Clint had held that stupid comm in his fist for the remaining 34 miserable hours in the Congo. He had clutched it as they'd been medevaced out during his long convalescence in a hospital in Seoul, watching some baffling TV show about a family that owned a bathhouse where everybody was terrible at getting married. Except they all got married. But they all still hung around the bathhouse driving each other insane. "I wonder if this makes more sense if you know Korean," he'd asked nobody, really, just out loud at the room in general. "Not as much as you'd think," Natasha had said, from where she was sitting cross-legged in the next bed, picking at something underneath her wrist cast with a bowie knife. Coulson, spellbound, hadn't said anything, just stuffed some more chocolate-filled koala cookies in his mouth and stared at the hospital monitor as bathhouse show faded into rival lady TV reporter show, which had promptly involved some kind of bus accident. It wasn't until almost a month later, finally on their way back to the U.S. on a commercial Asiana flight, that Clint had said, shy and quiet, "Here, sir," and handed Coulson his comm. Coulson had smiled at him a little, in that way that sometimes slipped out from underneath the perfect seams and hems of him, and said, "Thank you, Barton." He'd slipped it into his ear, where it had sat, probably still warm from Clint's hand, and prompted one of the most Victorian erections Clint's ever had. For that entire period, there's only one post out of a dozen from PC that's not strictly Captain America business. And it says, "Pam makes me nuts." "Maybe he means Natasha," Clint mutters to himself under his breath, which is such a terrible thought, he scrolls to the bottom of the file to read backwards for a while. Only he frowns when he realizes either the dates are wrong or Jarvis screwed up. There's stuff dated after May 4. And the flutter of hope that crashes in Clint's throat only lasts long enough for him to double and triple check that none of these posts are by PC. Just a glitch then, Clint thinks, and grabs a pen. It's stolen from Bank of America. All of Clint's pens are stolen from banks. He writes, "Ask Jarvis why bus monitor posts," up his wrist, "because landlord stuff, leak, paint," and "get some normal dog food, Jesus," is taking up all the space on his palm. At that point, Katie Cat wakes up long enough to punch him in the hip until Clint says, "Jesus, Fine, fine, stop hitting me, and lies down to sleep. He thinks it's stupid. There's no way he's going to sleep at all. He thinks that, seriously, Hawkeye is the worst, most spoiled brat. And then he doesn't think anything, just feeling Kate's palm pressed flat over his chest, and the warm press of bedroom darkness sweeping him away.